Hey everybody, this is Luisa, and today I have the opportunity to interview Leo Flores of Code Pink. Hi, Leo.
Hi, Luisa.
Leo Flores is a Latin American campaign coordinator with Code Pink. He holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy from the University of Maryland, and he proudly dropped out of a master's program at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy to work as an analyst on U.S.-Venezuela relations. Leo was born in Venezuela and maintains close ties to social movements that have transformed the country over the past 20 years. Leo, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So can you tell me, you're Venezuelan, so can you tell me a little bit about your background and why you maintain close ties to your home country?
Sure. So I was born in Venezuela, but my family moved to the U.S. when I was really young, actually. I was about 1.5, and they moved to the D.C. area. And back then in the 80s, it was still kind of inexpensive to travel to Venezuela. So we would go back maybe every summer, every other summer. And one of the things that would always catch my eye was just the inequality, right? The economic inequality, because you land in the airport, and between going to the airport and going to Caracas, you drive and you see on the hills people basically living in tin shacks. And then you arrive in Caracas and it's a city where there's, you know, skyscrapers and mansions and like fancy cars. And as a kid, this really shocked me because here where I live in DC, the inequality is a little bit more hidden, right? You have to like travel a little further to see, you know, I grew up in kind of a middle-class neighborhood and kind of poverty was hidden. And so I think that kind of led me to become a socialist in part, because as soon as I started reading about socialism, I was like, oh, well, this makes sense to me. This is kind of what I've been experiencing in terms of, you know, that pain you feel when you see these kind of inequalities. And then in 1998, Hugo Chavez won the elections, and I wasn't quite sure really who he was. And I wasn't kind of super convinced until I saw the constitution that Venezuelans drafted themselves in 1999, and they voted on in a referendum. And they approved it, and it was incredibly progressive. And then I thought, oh, wow, something really interesting is going on here. And it's something that I'm not really too, you know, I wasn't really kind of a part of at the time. And so I got more curious and did more research. And then by the time the coup attempt in 2002 came along, that totally convinced me, because there you had a coup where basically the armed forces and the government elite overthrew the government for 48 hours. But the people rose up and reverted the coup. They reversed it within the period of one weekend. And it was just so inspiring to see, you know, the mass mobilization of people saying, we want our president back, we want our democracy back. This is the path we've chosen, and we were insisting on it. And since then, you know, I was completely converted, and I made it kind of my mission to get involved in a way. And so I got involved mostly through working at the the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. And it was through the Venezuelan embassy that I got to make a lot of contacts with social movements, with communes, with feminist organizations and leaders. And those ties have kind of, you know, helped me over the years, not just to understand what's going on in Venezuela, but they've inspired me to kind of keep up the anti-imperialist fight here in the U.S.
So taking a turn in the other direction, but still timely, the OAS, they're having the Summit of the Americas that's taking place June 6th through 10th in Los Angeles in the United States. If you'll bear with me, I'm actually going to read from the State Department website, their definition of what the Summit of the Americas is. And then I'd like you to define it as a Latin American who's organizing not just against the legal sanctions, but also U.S. imperialism at large. So, and again, forgive me, the State Department says only the Summit of the Americas brings together leaders from the countries of North, South, and Central America and the Caribbean. The summit and its stakeholder forums promote cooperation towards region-wide inclusive economic growth and prosperity based on our shared respect for democracy, fundamental freedoms, the dignity of labor, and free enterprise. So can you tell me what the OAS, Summit of the Americas, actually is?
Yeah, so the OAS, the Organization of American States, the easiest way to understand what it is, it's a tool for the State Department, for the U.S. government, to influence Latin America and the Caribbean. And since 1994, they've had these massive summits where they invite supposedly every country in the Americas, except of course, since 94 until I think it was 2015, Cuba was excluded. So right off the bat, you know, they talk about, you know, the largest gathering of hemispheric leaders. That's not even true anymore, because there's another organization in the region called CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. And they also have massive summits. And the only countries that aren't really invited are the United States and Canada. So that's two countries missing. But from the Summit of the Americas this time around, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela are not invited. So three countries missing. So this summit is actually smaller than the SALAC summits that we generally have. And the thing about the Summit of the Americas is it's that it's basically a showcase for the United States to, you know, propose policies for the next 5 years or so, 3 to 5 years, and to showcase for basically pliant governments that are, you know, in the thrall of the United States to show what they've been doing in order to kind of converge policy-wise with the United States. And it's often been a disaster. So for example, in 2018, the theme of the Summit of the Americas was corruption. And yet it was held in Peru. And 3 weeks before it was held, the Peruvian president was basically, he was taken out of office because of corruption issues, right? And so there was massive corruption scandal right before this huge anti-corruption summit. This time around, they're talking about the Summit of the Americas in LA being about democracy and about freedom. And yet they're excluding these three countries, Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. And on the other hand, they're inviting their, you know, countries like Colombia, which is very clearly a narco dictatorship, Brazil, which is sliding into a dictatorship as well with Bolsonaro, and you know, similar countries in the region that have a lot of democratic problems, including the United States itself, of course. So really what the Summit of the Americas represents for many of us in the global South, particularly in Latin America and the Caribbean, is it's an example of the utmost hypocrisy of the United States. It's a showcase really for the United States to show how false they are when it comes to things like human rights and democracy.
Okay, and then can you tell us what the counter to that is, what the People's Summit is?
Yeah, so since 2002 in Quebec, when they held the Summit of the Americas, in 2002, there was a mass protest against the Summit of the Americas. And that became institutionalized. So in 2005, when it was in Argentina, there was the first official counter summit. And at that counter summit, Hugo Chavez spoke and he declared the free trade agreement of the Americas to be completely dead. And so at that point, the counter summit became more important than the summit itself, because that's where the news was breaking. This time around, there's a counter summit. It's called the People's Summit for Democracy. The website is peoplesummit2022.org. It's being held in LA from June 8th through 10th. And it's basically 3 days of art and music, speakers, debates, workshops, panel discussions, protests, all of which are meant really to uplift the voices of the people and imagine a new world that really puts democracy first.
Okay. And then we've been, us as individuals, we've been working on a project together along with a team of other folks, the Venezuelan Feminist Tour. The tour is comprised of three women from Venezuela who will be visiting seven Democratic Socialists of America chapters across the U.S. to discuss the impact of illegal U.S. sanctions, but from a feminist perspective, right? You can visit the Old Mole website with that links to the DSA International Committee landing page for more information, or visit the DSA International Committee or Code Pink Twitter accounts. There's emerging research from by organizations, independent human rights organizations, but even organizations like the UN, which is dominated by US power, right? We see this when it comes to votes regarding Palestine, for instance. They've demonstrated, even the UN has demonstrated, how women and children are disproportionately, they bear the brunt of illegal sanctions. So can you please talk about the women who will be visiting us, the three women, but then also some of the research that's been done on this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So the three women, and I'm really excited that they're coming on this tour. They're all, you know, very connected to social movements and political movements in the country. One of them is named Monica. She's an arts administrator. She's Afro-Venezuelan. She manages this kind of Afro-Venezuelan drum group that is beyond being a band. They also provide workshops and education, and it's a way to keep Afro-Venezuelan musical traditions alive. And so, you know, very excited about her. She's a professor at the National Experimental Arts University in Caracas. The second person coming is, her name is Angie. She's Wayuu. Wayuu is one of the biggest indigenous nations in Venezuela. They're kind of on the western part of Venezuela, on the border with Colombia. The Wayuu territory actually encompasses both parts of Colombia and Venezuela. She is, you know, an indigenous rights activist and a women's rights activist as well. She worked on reproductive rights. She's part of various social movements, and she comes from like a long line of indigenous Wayuu activists. In fact, her brother is, I think, the first Wayuu filmmaker in Venezuela, and her mother was one of the people who was, helped shape indigenous policy in the country. And thirdly, we have Yolimar, last but not least. Yolimar is an industrial engineer. She's worked at the state-owned oil company, PDVSA. She's also worked at Petrocaribe. But more importantly, she's worked as a teacher for Misión Sucre. And so Venezuela over the last 20-some years has these things called social missions, which have been really provided education and health and other social needs to underserved populations. And Misión Sucre was a way to get, adults free higher education. We're talking about adults who previously might not even have graduated high school and were denied educational opportunities for their whole life. But then through this mission, they got more access to education. So that's what I'm really looking forward to listening to from Yolimar. And they're not all going to talk about how these sanctions have primarily hurt women and children in the country. I mean, if we look at the statistics, they're really kind of jaw-dropping, right? According to a former UN Special Rapporteur, Alfred de Zayas, 100,000 people died from the sanctions alone between 2017 and 2020. That's building off research from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a think tank in DC, that found that 40,000 people died in the first year alone. So that number has probably gone a lot higher. And let me just end this part by reading this quote from Alina Duhan, who's the current UN Special Rapporteur on basically sanctions. She wrote this after a fact-finding mission to Venezuela. She wrote, "The economic blockade of Venezuela and the freezing of central bank assets have a devastating effect on the whole population of Venezuela, especially those in extreme poverty, women, children, medical workers, people with disabilities or life-threatening or chronic diseases, and the indigenous population." And just to give like one little stat, in 2015, the top children's hospital in Venezuela was performing 5 heart surgeries per day. By 2020, because of the sanctions, because of how the sanctions destroyed the economy, affecting investment into the healthcare sector and preventing medical equipment and other goods from entering the country, that same hospital was down to 120 surgeries per year. So less than 1 a day, whereas before it was 5 a day. So that's, and it's really been the healthcare sector that's been hit the hardest, and of course the economy. And when the economy gets hit, it's women who bear the brunt of it.
You know, it's always difficult when we talk about illegal sanctions against these countries, because we never want to paint Venezuelans, Cubans, Nicaraguans, Iranians, whoever, as just victims, right? And so, for instance, so talking about resistance, one positive development as a result of illegal sanctions that passed under Trump has been food sovereignty for Venezuelans, right? So prior to the blockade, Venezuela imported most of its food. And now, because of the food scarcity that blockade caused, Venezuelans have developed farming programs, communes, working with communes in cooperation with private sector, to the point where the majority of food in Venezuela is produced locally. So can you give us just a couple examples of the forms of Venezuelan resistance to the U.S. government?
Yeah, and let's make it clear that the sanctions were designed to suffocate the Venezuelan people to the point that they would rise up and overthrow their own government. But that hasn't happened. And why hasn't it happened? Because it's the people themselves who are organizing to be able to survive, right? And let me give you a couple of examples. And when we're talking about the issue of food sovereignty, there's been a couple of very important programs. One is kind of a people's initiative. It's called Plan Pueblo a Pueblo, the people-to-people plan. And then through that, you had consumers, particularly those in cities, in particularly poorer neighborhoods, they organized together, they contacted their counterparts in rural Venezuela, the people who are growing the food, and they came up with a scheme, basically, I don't know, call it like a CSA on a much larger scale, right? Where they would directly purchase from the producers, ensuring the producers have a market and have a kind of income before the harvest. And then they would get the food directly, cutting out any sort of brokers or middlemen who might jack up the prices because, again, another of the impacts of sanctions is hyperinflation. A similar program, but this one led by the government, is called CLAP, which are local committees for supply and production. Through this CLAP food program, 7 million families get this box of food and other necessities at least once a month. And that has been incredibly, useful and life-saving in terms of being able to ensure that Venezuelans don't starve and aren't undernourished. And at the same time, the undernourishment level has gone up quite a bit, but without these sorts of programs, the situation would be significantly worse. And there's been all sorts of kind of ingenuity going on. So for example, there's another group called the Productive Workers Army. And these are, women and men who are technicians or laborers in kind of manufacturing centers And what they do is they get together kind of on the weekends, or they take time off, and they go to state-owned companies, and they fix them. Because one of the problems with the sanctions, again, is the lack of being able to import equipment, not just because of lack of money, but because sometimes banks block those transactions. I'm talking about regular transactions for, you know, manufacturing, you know, I don't know, tuna fish or whatever, right? And so they go to these factories that were, many of them were worker controlled, and then they teach the workers how to kind of repair the machines themselves without having to rely on outside goods coming in. So we have all sorts of really innovative programs that are going on. Urban agriculture has really skyrocketed in the past 5 to 10 years. And this is what's really led, you know, the country to be able to survive, and not just survive. It seems like the bottom, you know, Venezuela hit bottom maybe last year, year and a half ago, because now everything indicates that the economy is starting to recover. Of course, it will never fully recover until the sanctions are lifted, just like Cuba, despite how amazing their, you know, biotech sector is. You know, their economy is never going to be normal until the blockade is lifted. And it's the same for Venezuela, same for every sanctioned country in the world, really.
Well, we can end the segment on more good news. The Venezuelan Feminist Tour is actually visiting Portland. So they will be with us June 6th at 6 p.m. at Taper Space in Portland, Oregon. Please wear your mask, as masks are required. Leo, thanks so much. Thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime. Thank you.